Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
So what we share with you today is going to be, to some degree, drawn from a book that Tom and I created a few years back. We're not going to cover all this. We're not even going to get close. We'd like to have, to some degree, a conversation, but we also would like to share some material with you. So if you're really curious about kind of the lay of the land, at least we tried to identify some of the frequent screw-ups in the book. But again, you know, how many ways are there to screw up a church plant? You know, one way more than you were planning. Like the agony of defeat. I don't know if anybody remembers those old Wide World of Sports intro clips. But, gosh, there's, you know, you just don't always anticipate the ways that they can go sideways. And let's just be clear. We're talking not about the execution of the planting project by the planter. We're talking about the execution of the prep work by the sponsoring agency, the parent congregation, okay? So these are two halves to a coin, two sides to a coin, and so that's kind of what we're gonna think about today. So we picked a few of the landmines. We identified maybe some new ones today. And we're going to just dip into a couple of them, and I'll share with you a bit, and then Tom's going to share for a bit, and we'll do play ping pong here together. And just a quick sense of scale here. this is a storyboard, what's called a parenting storyboard, that we developed with CoachNet, Bob Logan's organization, of a few years back. It identifies about 12 different action domains around parenting a new church, under which there are three or four specific activities. You know, so I mean, there are lots of different elements to executing a new church start from the parents' side, and it just adds the potential ways in which you can underperform, right? And so we're going to just take a look at a few of those. So with no further introduction, let's go to what I think of as a values disconnect. Because what can happen when you're giving birth to a new congregation, you think about those 12 different kind of action domains and the sub areas and the to-do list, you start building that out and you say, wow, there's a lot to do here, and you can reduce the birthing of a new church to a lot of mechanics. You know, if we just get the mechanics right, get the action areas, create kind of a checklist. But one thing that I learned after having, I'll never forget, having Leith Anderson, who's kind of the dean of church planting in North America, maybe along with several others, going back a long time ago. Leith came, shared with a bunch of our congregations in the Reformed Church in America. We were trying to plant 450 churches in 10 years. And Leith laid out the mechanics of how to do it. And then he left town. And I watched all those folks that came to that terribly inspiring event, not perform, not execute. And it's because of the absence, really, of pre-existing values that were far more important than the mechanics of, you know, shopping the site and hiring the planter and raising the budget. And, I mean, there are deep values that really propel all the mechanics forward. And failure to cultivate those values, call them out, call them aspirational values, because, you know, maybe some of them aren't real present in our culture. Call them just absent values and things we really need to say, hey, this is a new day for us. Bob Logan, how many of you have seen this list before? I think this is one of the more underreported lists. Bob Logan observed a long time ago, whenever he watched congregations that were effective at giving birth to new churches, he observed that the presence of these values were highly predictive of the ease and call it the seamlessness wherewith they went ahead and multiplied. When the values were present, it's not that all the values had to be present. It's not like, you know, if these aren't here, don't do it. But just be aware of the fact that if these aren't here, there's going to be a higher degree of resistance and anxiety and confusion and deer in the headlights moments around the experience of planting. Someone said this yesterday, I think, in one of the sessions. One of the plenary session presenters said this better than I'm trying to say it. Do you remember how that came out? It was just like, if the values are there, the mechanics follow. Did you hear that? Somebody say that yesterday? I've heard. Maybe Alan Hirsch, yeah. He would always say things better than I would say them. But but I think Logan's identification of, you know, these values is just really crisp and clean, and say, you know, I work right now with, I'm now working with the United Methodist Church, another huge kind of a sleeping giant, denominational giant in North America, 33,000 congregations or thereabouts. And we say, you know, for a congregation that wants to birth another church, what's your level of just compassion for lost people? What's your level of, you know, this just sense of, I know who I'm praying for, I know who I'd long to see, you know, in God's kingdom family. And then what do you need to do at your church to cultivate and to stir up that value? So I won't go down through all of those. But there's one I do want to just take a linger on for just a moment. We talk a little bit more about those in the book. That's a little pitch for the book. Tom, we're going to make a living here, buddy. Yeah. But there's a value that I haven't named. It wasn't one of Bob Logan's named values, but it's a developmental kind of a concept that is a value. Anybody know whose mug that is? That's not Bob Logan. Anybody know whose mug that is? Yeah. How many of you heard the name Eric Erickson? Developmental psychologist, right? Erickson identifies these stages of developmental maturity and growth. And he identifies them oppositionally. He says, for instance, the first developmental growth, psychic developmental growth issue we have, psychological growth issue we have, is trust or mistrust. Whether we can bond to our parent, whether we can have a sense of, you know, trusting relationship. And if we successfully navigate that, we grow then psychologically to another level. At the other end of 7, 8 developmental steps for Erickson, he says, is this developmental conflict between what he calls generativity and stagnation. I think it's a really illuminating concept when you think about values and having that kind of value base from which you execute a parenting objective. And that generativity, anybody think of a definition? You know, have you heard the term generativity? Not much, but
no.
Does that sound anywhere? Anybody stab a guess as to how would you define generativity? To be a generative person? Exactly. You're probably not supposed to use a word in a definition, but I think you're leaning in the right direction, right? Yeah. Initiator. It's like, the way I think of it is, it's not about you anymore. Being a generative person is all about helping other, lifting up other people and seeing them succeed. It's being a source to see others benefit, to be a rung on somebody else's ladder, right? That's the way I think of being a generative person. So Erickson, I think, and for a lot of congregations, it's thinking of themselves as, are we a generative place? And for the leadership and for pastoral leadership, am I primarily thinking of myself in that level of being a generative person. It's really interesting what Erickson thinks the opposite. You know, folks who'd never achieve that, they stagnate from a developmental standpoint. So that's the kind of this deep values that drive the mechanics around parenting. Here's a few things you can do to strengthen your multiplication values. One is you can assess your church for values. And Tom and I have a little assessment tool in the book, and it will help you assess your relative strength in those seven variables. You can preach and teach those values. By gosh, by golly, that would be a good thing to do. You can plan to act and to embody the values. Make some choices around those areas. And certainly, you know, whatever you celebrate, you become. We all understand that. I included a website there where you can find an online assessment of those values as well. So that's one. The landmine would be, again, saying, well, we're just going to execute these. We're just going to get out there and start. And I'm not opposed to, I'm an action-oriented person. But understand that the degree to which you have some clarity around the values that are driving it, that you're preaching them, that's the internal driver, that generativity, that value base is clear in people's minds, will certainly calibrate the degree to which you'll move through the parenting activity with ease or with greater difficulty.
My name's Tom Niebel, and I mentioned earlier where I live in Madison, Wisconsin, but for I've been around church planting world, I don't know, something like 30 years, but more recently my role was as the National Director of Church Planting International as well with Converge Worldwide, and saw about 800 churches planted over the time that I served with Converge. And, you know, it's always better in the books than it is in real life. We know that that's true, so you know, it's just kind of a messy thing. But I'm going to show you something that I stumbled upon a while back that I think is going to save you tens of thousands of dollars and probably hundreds of hours of headache. Okay, and it has to do with environmental risk. Now, before you scratch a bunch of stuff down, actually, let me do this for a moment. Oops, I wanted to. Actually, I'm just going to take us off of that for a moment. So I just want to show you something that you might have some knowledge of. You might know that it was about 15 to 20 years ago. Hey, folks, maybe if it looks like people still kind of rolling in, maybe we ought to kind of shift over a little bit this way. And then if people are coming in, it's less inconvenient for them to find a seat. But you might know that around 20 years ago, it was only about 20% of new churches that were started were succeeding past their fifth birthday. Now, things have gotten better, and you might have, you know, if you pay attention statistically, right now, across North America anyway, it might not be the same in Peru, right? But across North America, about 68% of churches are succeeding at least to their fifth birthday. So there is a positive growth that's occurred, and I think it's because we've become better stewards. Okay, when we just reduce this to mechanics, then we're doing a disservice to the Spirit of God and what you know and our dependency upon Him. But what we are also saying is, let's be better at what we're doing. Okay, so here's the things that started to change that. Number one, we figured out that we assess church planters, right? And most of us know about that. If you don't, hit us up later. But we're just basically saying there's about 13 to 15, depending, you know, who you're talking to, that those are the indicators you look at church planters, see if they have what it takes. By the way, most movements are better off if they are church planter focused rather than church planting focused. Okay, so you're putting your resources into your individuals. And the best thing you can do is to have an objective assessment whether the ones that you're looking at should be church planting. You do that, at least in our movement, what we saw is our success rate went up to about 65%. Okay. So along the journey, I'm going, all right, what else? Because 65% 20 years ago was better than average. But you're still looking at 35% of the people that are crashing and it's not working. And you know, and I heard a couple of you say, hey, our churches are 14 years old or 45 years old. We're about to start the birthing process. And you know you want a win out of this thing. Because if you don't get a win, then you've got all the detractors. It's going to be really hard to reload, right? So let's get this one as a win. We can take some shrapnel in the days to come, but let's come out of the gates and get a win on this one. So the best thing we can do, if you get your values and all those things are being oriented properly, is let's make sure whoever we're relegating to become the church planter gets assessed. Okay. Now, good enough. So I'm going, 65%, how can we do better? And that's when I kind of stumbled upon a process we call coaching. Okay, and that just means nobody plants alone. And if we make sure that people are getting strategic encouragement along the way, their resolve and their capacity to do it well increases. So when we started to do that, we were hitting at about 75% of a success rate. So awesome. I mean, we're getting to be better stewards. Now, I'm going to show you something that has brought us and anybody that I know who's doing it. If you're doing this and this, this next piece I'm going to show you, which has to do with environmental risk, this will save you hundreds of thousands of dollars if you're a movement. It'll save you hundreds of thousands of dollars. It will also, just on an individual church level, it will help to demystify a major, major landmine, and it has to do with environmental risk. So that's what I'm going to hit very quickly. And as to this issue of, Ben, you feeling like you're hawking books or something here. Frankly, we can get a lot of this stuff to you. Just hit us up. You know, we can send you PDFs on this. As far as, you know, book sales, I mean, yay, every time we sell a book, we each get a quarter.
Is it? I thought it was 20 cents.
It might be about that. So it's not. Okay, but I'm going to show you something called environmental risk, and we're going to go at it pretty quickly. But this is going to bring you to 85 to 90% of success. All right? Now, I want you to think, okay, now some of you, let me just ask. Many of you said you were about to start birthing. If you do not already have your church planter figured out, you've got to make sure you're doing assessment. Okay, if the ship has already sailed, well, you know, and we cross our fingers and trust on Jesus, okay? Okay. But there is another issue, because as I was leading church planting movements, I started to say, why is it that this person, this couple is assessed and given the go-ahead, and they're also being coached, and they're doing well, but you got this other couple, let's say, who are assessed and coached, but it's not going so well. Okay, so here's the idea behind environmental risk factors. I can take a very good church planter, very good church planting couple, and I, no matter how awesome they are, the people who are on the stage this week, no matter what awesomeness they have, I can find a situation where I could put them in a place where the risks are unmanageable. So what I want you to do is to be calibrating how to assess risk. So you use this little 8-step tool, and you either get a yellow light, a red light, or a green light. And it has nothing to do with, can they plant a church? It has everything to do with, should they plant a church in this situation and at this time, okay? Now, I'll send this PDF to you in no time, okay? And use it. I ran into some people yesterday. They said, Tom, this has saved us thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and headaches. So here we go. Don't even bother to write these down, because don't even bother. Just let me just tell you, we're going to look at four. Don't even bother. We're going to go one by one rather rapidly. But what we're going to say is there are I talked about assessing, insisting they have a coach, training, and then discerning environmental risk factors. So here we go. There's four strong factors and four moderate factors, and the highest score you can get is a 32. Now, you don't even need to write these down, okay, because I'm going to start scrolling through. But the four strong factors are, how are they funded? Do they have a cultural fit? If you grew up in New York City and you're going to plant in Omaha, could you do that? Probably. How about in Hayseed, Wyoming? Well, do we need cross-cultural missionaries? Sure. But I'm just going to say you add up too much risk, and now you're being presumptive. Okay, so we talk about a cultural fit, number of ministry partners. Those are the people that are moving with you and are part of the event that you've had some history with, and then number of pre-existing contacts. You can score 1 to 5 on these. We're going to do it in just a moment. Think of a church planter that succeeded, and think of one that failed. And if they were assessed and coached properly, okay. But moderate factors: how close are you to friends and family? How close are you to your geographical roots? How close are you to helpful churches? And lastly, how much prior ministry success have you had? Let me show you how this works. Put somebody in your mind, and if you got a little sheet of paper or you're good at math, just run a running total. Okay? Here we go. How will the planter be personally funded? Well, if somebody says, we're going by faith because we know God's going to provide, we applaud that. A lot of people do that. You can get seminars about that here. Okay, all I'm saying is you only get a point for that. Okay, and bivocational, you're working another job, you get 2 points. The partial support, that means you've raised some money and you're duct taping this together, we give you 3. You got a spouse situation where the spouse is the breadwinner and money is not the issue, we're going to give you 4. And if you have fully funded, you got the rich uncle, you're United Methodist or whatever, okay, you get 5 points, okay? Somebody running numbers right now? You thinking about somebody? Look at this one, cultural site. Selection background. How close is the site you're going to match your cultural experience? Well, not really. You get 1 point. A little. I know it's subjective, but this works. Okay. You get 2 points. Moderately, 3 points. Pretty much, 4 points. Absolutely, 5 points. Okay. So you start to run. You just start to do the numbers on this. New York City to Hayseed, Wyoming. You know, do we need cross-cultural missionaries? Yeah. Do we need cross-cultural missionaries that don't have any money? Now we're getting presumptive, right? We're getting scary. So here's what I'm saying. Is you're parenting, you got to say, is there are the risk factors manageable? Because we love risk. We just don't like dumb. Okay? Okay, again, you can get 5 points on this one. Do you have people moving with you? Ministry partners, you think of people who have had history with you. Okay, none, you get 1 point. 1 or 2, you get 2 points. 3 or 4, you get 3 points. 5 or 6, you get 4 points. 7 or more, you get 5 points. This is the advantage of being a parent church, by the way, because a lot of times, if you're wise with it and you're not just like deploying people who are problematic, you know, get them out of here, you're given some strength. Okay. So again, could somebody move from Hayseed, Wyoming to Montreal? Well, sure, we need cross-cultural missionaries. Could they do it without money? Now we're getting a little worried. Now, can they do it without bringing anybody with them? Now I don't like it. How about this one? This is the last of the 4 strong ones. How many pre-existing adult contacts might join them? I mean, somebody's already on site. You know, you're moving to Port what?
Fort Pierce.
You know, do you have anybody there that might be a friendly face and already be starting or participating? Now, there's a whole story too about who's in front of the train, and I kind of don't like pre-existing core groups. Okay, so that's another story. But do you have anybody you can fish from? Okay, so if you have a bunch, awesome. Okay, look at these moderate factors, 1 to 3. How close are your friends and family? Why? Because you under pressure, you want to go back to where people like you. So much for the family piece, right? But you want to be back where you're going to be supported. So if they're an airplane away, get 1 point. If they're within a drive for a weekend, 2 points. If they're nearby, 3 points. A lot of dynamics related to this, okay? It could be everything from emotional support to who's going to watch the kids to et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So can somebody move from Texas to Wisconsin to plant a church? Yes. I live in Wisconsin, had a lot of Bible Belt Texans come, but I'm telling you what, these other things don't line up, you know. Okay. How close are they to geographical roots? Well, that's a little different than culture, but I heard Jeff say earlier, 35 minutes from Lambeau Field. How do pastors plan, when do pastors plan their ministry schedule for the year? The day after the Packers schedule comes out, right? Because you don't want to have the hot dog supper that conflicts with the Packers-Seahawks game. Right. So that's a cultural, you know, that's cultural and geographical. Okay. So can a person who's lived in Omaha learn to live in this in the oppressive heat and humidity of Florida? Yeah, but it doesn't you're going to complain along the way, okay? And we're just saying somewhat, you know, not close at all, somewhat quite a bit. Let me go quickly. How close are you to helpful churches? Again, this is where parenting makes a difference, because there's the strength of the body of Christ, which has to do with prayer, has to do with somebody's got a condo on the beach for you to use, which has to do with, yes, we'll send a worship team over. It's all that kind of stuff, you know. So you get one, two, or three on that. And the last is not environmental, but have you had any success in vocational ministry before? Because if you have, we're going to give you three. If you had, I mean, a lot. If you had just a little, we'll give you two. And if you've had none, then we're going to give you one. Now, when I started church planning, I had none. Okay, so you can absorb risk. This is what it is. Without faith, it's impossible to please God, right? We heard that yesterday. So here's what we do with it. We just say, if you're 8 to 15, we give you a red light. We say, we don't want you to do that here or now. It might mean recruit two more families. Or it might mean, no, not right here, but 20 miles down the road. Okay? So this is what you got to be wise with. And then the middle area, can do, is the that's the yellow, that's 16 to 23. When we planted, we were around like 18 or something. It worked out fine. Okay, you just want to be wise. In this other one, the low risk is like, wow, this just really seems like it makes sense. Let's go with it. Now, I'm going to give you one more story before I turn it back to Ben. I will get you this, by the way. You know, we'll give you our stuff. You'll get the PDF at least by this weekend, and you just keep printing it off and using it. But this will help you as a parent church to it's a thing you can avoid, because especially if you live in a destination area like Florida, okay, and everybody a lot of people out looking for work, and they're, oh yeah, I want to go to Florida, you know, or whatever it might be. You got to be careful that the environmental risks are working. So here's my story. I'm thinking of a couple, and I saw the church planter yesterday, and I saw him this morning from Wisconsin. This is about 15 years ago. They planted a church. They assessed well. They were coached well. And they were in a place where a parent church got behind them. So guess what they scored on this? They scored a 32, straight 32. The risk factors environmentally could not be better. That church was 1,200 people in about 18 months in a mid-sized town in north central Wisconsin. That same couple got recruited to move to Florida about 10 years ago. Their risk factors, it was a 13. They're not yet at 200 people. Okay? So I'm just saying, as an issue of stewardship, this is a landmine you can avoid if, in addition to assessing and coaching, that you're calibrating the environmental risk, okay? Take it away, Ben. By the way, this is just to say, look at what happens, how these things are improved when you're wise with. Okay, so, or should we take question and answer, or Ben, are you ready to?
We can do it now or later. Or...
Yeah, why don't we just take comment on that?
That's good.
Just the area of.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm 58, and I'm just about, you know, starting to get emotionally healthy. But, yeah, oh, well, yeah. I mean, dysfunction is the, yeah. But all I'm going to say is what we're talking about here has to do with assessing people. You know, that because what we do is when we do assess, we want to know at least if there's humility and there's a pathway toward toward well-being. But so I'm just saying, as a parent church or an organization that's planting churches, that should factor in.
What you may be dealing really with is the issue of recruiting. You know, is whenever we don't recruit widely enough for a position and we have just a very small pool of potential leaders to draw from, then we go with who we got. And that's a mistake right there. You ought to be doing a very wide recruiting. Throw your net wide in order to find the very best person that God has raised up for the job.
And this is why, and Ben and I will tell you, listen, folks, don't be calendar driven. You know, be health driven. I know, hey, by God's grace, we want to plant a church in 2017 and all that. But I'm telling you what, you would much rather, if it takes another 6 months, 8 months to get the right person, you would much rather do that than push whoever is in your limited pool out there. Yeah. Let's roll.
Oh, go ahead. One more question.
I'm going to go back to the issue of who are your ministry partners. Now, but the thing is, there's a whole lot more to this, but I'm about to say you want to be careful about forced marriages. And a lot of times in assessment processes, somebody they'll buddy up, they'll meet each other for the first time, and they'll go, oh, yeah, we kind of fall in love. Well, you can fall in love with anybody, you know, over a course of a few days. But this is the values disconnect that Ben is referring to, because let me just put it like this. You know, it's like if you and I are standing next to each other, okay, and you say, yeah, and I say, yeah, here's the kind of church I have envisioned, you know, and there's my big arrow, and you're going, oh, wow, totally, I really agree with you, that's perfect. You know, if this is a timeline, right here we don't feel very far apart, right? But somewhere in that 18 to 22-month range is when we start to really feel far apart. So we're going to talk about the power of paper in just a little bit about how to discern some of those things so you're on the right page.
Yeah, Tom's got another book out called Church Planter Landmines, and you kind of touch on that there in terms of leadership backlash, yeah, that kind of thing. So go to Tom if you want to mine into that more deeply. Let me tell you a story. Oh, go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, I think that's why there's just some subjectivity built in here. But I'll tell you what, use this as a coaching tool anyway. Because even if someone comes in at, let's say, an 18, you can say to them, boy, we could run with this, but what would it take for us to reduce that by five more or add five more points of health onto it? So I do that with everybody. I'd say, could you raise another $1,000 a month? Could you recruit one more family? You know, but I understand, yeah, there's some flexibility as far as that goes. But the power of paper is really important. And what good coaches do and what good parent churches do is they say, hey, we want to get more out of you. We want greater success. Because most churches are 2 to 3 times the size of their launch team a year after they've launched. So we want to get this thing as healthy as possible. It's subjective,
some of that. Let me tell you another story. This is the front page of the newspaper in my town going back about 4 or 5 years ago when an Episcopal church did a really cool thing. They observed what I'm going to hunch a lot of us observed is that our communities are changing, and one of the ways they're changing is diversity, and we're watching ethnic communities come and settle, and they're looking to start their own churches. And so we say, hey, here's a great opportunity for our church to nest a Hispanic congregation or to nest a sub-Saharan congregation, or my church, we're nesting a Bhutanese congregation. So this is a landmine that I'm watching beginning to fire off because the Episcopal Church in town had a wonderful relationship with the Sudanese group for about 3 years. And then it blew up. And it didn't blow up because of a values disconnect, like they or like we're headed in different directions. It blew up because the relationship broke down between the two groups. It was really a loss or a lack of cultural intelligence on the part of both groups. But I think the Episcopal group really should have upped their game before they opened their doors to nest another congregation. We work with a lot of congregations in the eastern part of the United States where property values are so high, and so nesting's really common if you go to New York City. I heard recently from Tim Keller's organization that 1 out of 10 New Yorkers, Manhattanites right now, is an immigrant Pentecostal. So you get this huge immigrant phenomenon there and a lot of nesting going on in Anglo congregations. And that may be one of the most unique and, I think, wonderful ways in which your church can parent a new church. If you do that, it behooves you not to step on this landmine. So let me think with you about it for a few moments. The folks at the Cultural Intelligence, David Livermore's organization, and others have identified cultural clusters globally, and I think we would probably all acknowledge that that the histories and the experiences of these different sectors of the world have created different cultural biases within those groups. We don't stereotype them, but at the same time, we notice tendencies and trends. There are all kinds of exceptions to those cultural values and tendencies, but I think we have to be aware of them and conscious of them if we step into a parenting, partnering relationship and want to be effective. And so I would offer you these 7 value variables. You know, one of the characteristics of a culturally intelligent leader is a drive for cross-cultural experience and cross-cultural relationship. But the second quality of an effective cross-cultural leader and cultural intelligence is an awareness of the cultural value variables and the capacity to lead with wisdom, paying attention to how those values show up in strategies and execution and relationship, and to maintain relationship, knowing what my values tend to be by virtue of my background and what the values of the folks I'm stepping into partnership with, not making one set of values better than others, but what their value base and how they've been enculturated differently than myself. So you've probably heard these. I'm not going to go through these in detail. You know, you think of it, and I'll just talk about the Bhutanese congregation right now that we're working with in the congregation that I'm involved with. And, you know, it's just so different. You think like, oh, all we need to do is get the leaders together and make the decisions, right? So let's get the leader of the Bhutanese congregation together with our leaders and let's make a decision and what have you. Totally disregarding that our individualistic culture, which tends to have a more hierarchical sense of leadership responsibility, roles, and that kind of thing, so different from Bhutanese culture. It's more collectivistic. They think of themselves as family, and this is very common for many other cultures. It's a way in which us Anglos differ from other culture groups in the world. And so this really shows up if your congregation decides to nest, and you say, how are we functioning effectively. Yeah, we got a question.
Define nest for me. Are you inviting them in, giving them space, and allowing them to do their thing?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, they're using our space.
Okay.
So there's a lot of just logistic decisions, space decisions, you know, mechanics decisions that have to be made. And we think, you know, that this is the way we make these decisions. We get the leaders together to make the decisions, you know. And at least this was an area that we had a wake-up call moment. It's like we just weren't paying attention to a difference, and it created tension. And so we had to then kind of, you know, recover a bit, threw us off balance in that area. You know, low versus high power distance, that's all about this hierarchical style versus a flat style. And really, in North America, we tend to be a much more low power distance kind of a culture. Hispanic culture, for instance, is more high power distance, where there is a much more hierarchical sense of, you know, that's the person who is in charge, and there's more deference in a sense. In our culture, you know, the world is flat, whether you agree or disagree with it, but there's more a sense of parity. You know, the people, as Steve Jobs, that was his vision, right, for email. The people on the line can speak to management and say what they're thinking, you know. Well, that just does not occur in other cultures. And to be aware of that, if you're leading in an environment where you're hosting or nesting or facilitating the parenting of an ethnic congregation. Low versus high uncertainty avoidance is all about risk tolerance. And in some cultures, we value the entrepreneurial, stick your chin out and go for it. In other cultures, there's a much greater sense of need for clarity and definition. And our entrepreneurialism, we live so closely in it in North America, we don't respect the fact that others do not drink from that same kind of, you know, high toxic brew, you know. So I can see some of you saying, yeah, I see where this is going. Cooperative versus competitive, time versus event. You can just kind of see all these showing up in low context, high context. You know, in North America, my yes means yes, my no means no, and my nonverbals don't always matter that much. But in other cultures, it's what you don't say, it's the nonverbals that are more important. People are paying much closer attention to the nonverbals than to the verbals. In fact, the verbals don't always matter that much. So, I mean, these are one's not better than the other, but an effective parent congregation, especially if you're nesting, I think this is a great opportunity in North America for church multiplication to come alongside the immigrant church. In many cases, with respect to, again, sub-Saharan Africans, Asians, and Latinos, they come with a higher degree of commitment to Christian faith than our indigenous North American population does. And so partnering with them, we've got the real estate sometimes, you know, your situation, Wayne, in Los Angeles. We've got the real estate. You know, but they've got the passion, the vision, the momentum, you know, and so it just feels so right to us to partner. That's a good impulse, but to steward that impulse wisely and to be culturally smart is, I think, really important. Yeah, low context, high context is, I guess, this is again. It can be a little confusing, but it's the way in which communication occurs. In North America, we tend to just value words, and people take one another, you know, at their word. In other cultures, it's the nonverbals, it's the context that matters much more. Other factors that communicate more. So. Here's Sarah Lanier, who's written a wonderful book. If this is an area of interest to you, a very quick Lanier's book, Foreign to Familiar. She's identified hot culture and cold culture and some of those qualities there. It's one take on it. But I think you can really enhance your CQ by owning your own cultural bias. Find a cultural interpreter, right? Someone that can tell you where you're not coming through, right? If you're going to enter into that kind of a parenting, multiplying partnership, find someone that will speak to you about where you are not, you're not coming through, all right? So assess your staff, train your staff in CQ. Again, this is, you know, the little nicks and the bruises and the offenses that can occur and how those can pile up and really break down. David Livermore, who trains multinational corporations around CQ, he says 70% of the breakdowns in the corporate world that are cross-cultural are because of low CQ. It's not because the profits aren't happening. It's not because it's because the relationships break down. So you have to train your leaders that are going to be partnering with others to be effective that way. Learn more about cultural value variables. Yeah, we've got just a few minutes for Tom to do another one. And this is really an important one, Tom does. So let's just hand it off. Go, Tom.
Sure, and what we'll do is we'll hang around after this, and we're happy to interact. But I'm going to try to get onto another key area. Now, relative to what Ben was just saying, the idea of nesting, and again, just a comment. I remember when we had our first child, my wife was very reluctant birth giver. She did not want to be pregnant. She did not want to have a baby. As soon as she was had the first baby, within 5 minutes, she says, oh, I could do that again. Okay. Now, that's not true for everyone who's ever given birth, right? So all I'm saying is, whatever you can do to make this, you know, get your first win, then you got your chance to move toward, right, toward level four and level five. Okay. Just a landmine, get your key agreements in writing. And I'm going to talk to you about a couple of areas, right? We know this from the scriptures, right? In order that Satan might not outwit us, for we're not unaware of his schemes. I just happen to think this is a scheme of the devil, and that's that we have unmet expectations. Okay? So when we have unmet expectations, there can be a lot of collision. We know that's true in any of our relationships, right? So I'm going to show you, I'm going to just give you the flyover. Again, you're going to have our contact information, send you anything we can send you to help you. And then I'm going to show you this tool. I work with an organization, you'll see on my email address, it's called Giant Worldwide. And what we do is we help a lot of this IQ, EQ, PQ stuff, but whether it's in companies or in churches or whatever. But we use so many visual tools. We used one yesterday called the Five Gears. Some of you might have been in on that. But this is called Provisional Plan and Promise. And all we're saying here, and I know in the back it might be a little hard to see this, but we're just saying, how certain are we about anything? And if it's low certainty, it's provisional. If it's high certainty, it's plan. And if it's we're doing it, then it's promise. So I think like a few years back, Ben and I were saying, hey, we got some stuff. Why don't we work on this book? At that point, it's provisional. Okay. Then we start to get a little bit more serious about it. Now we're saying, wait, this is the plan, and now this is the promise. If you know anything about Myers-Briggs typology, J people go straight for the J's go straight for promise. P's go straight for provision. So I have a son named Andrew, and we use this tool all the time. Andrew, what you just told me, I thought you were saying a promise. He says, no, Dad, I was provisional. Okay. And I'll say, okay, got it. And then further conversation might be, okay, is this our plan? Are we going to the cottage 2 weekends from now? Oh, yeah. Wait, is that provisional plan promise? Because unmet expectations just become the devil's playground. This happens like crazy in the planning of new churches. So I'm going to give you just a few areas where you've got to get your stuff on paper and not just settle for goodwill.
Yep.
Okay? So here we go. Expectations interview. That's what the parent church and the church plant can expect from each other. Now, I've got a document. I will send it to you. There's examples in the back of this book, too. But I can send you a document, and it goes through just about everything you could imagine, but you customize it and make it your own. It could be things like, we expect you as a church planter to take a day off once a week from ministry. You know, and it could be everything from, we expect you, you know, say denomination, we expect you to give back a certain amount of money at certain times. You know, I mean, it'd be these kind of things. So where does that come from? It comes from everything that's ever gone wrong. So you start to say, because we want promise. We don't want, wait a minute, for us this is a promise and for you it's provision. No, we want the expectations interview. What you can expect from me, what I can expect from you, and we call it an expectations interview. People initial it off. Yep, we're going to do this. Yes, we'll show up for this meeting. Yes, we'll do that. Yes, we'll do that. Yes, we'll do that. You just want that on paper. Okay, demystify it so it doesn't become a thing that can mess with you. A letter of call, that has to do with the precise parameters of employee-employee relationship. So that's just the, now we're down into the details. By the way, my most recent book that I wrote with Steve Pike, who is the Assemblies of God church planning director, we've got a bunch of stuff in there on this, and it's called, there's a whole chapter called The Power of Paper, But that book is called Leading Church Multiplication, and that's just like a toolbox full of this kind of stuff. Again, Ben and I will send you anything you want, just with the click of a click. Okay. And then lastly, values and agenda harmony, and that's how the planter can discern the agendas of launch team members. So parent church pastors, let me just say this. Be careful about deploying people. Let's say you're in Aville and you're going to plant a church in Beeville. Be careful that you do not assign people to the launch team for the new church planter. What you want is the church planter to have fishing rights. And that what the church planter needs to do, though, is to do values and agenda harmony issues because of this stuff, right? What's this new church going to look like? Well, this is going to be a contemporary church. Well, I'm glad we got that settled. What does contemporary mean? We don't know. Oh, awesome. He said contemporary. You know, honey, we love those Gaither tunes. Right? And then somewhere down the road, you're like, man, we just blew this up. Or, yeah, we want to be engaged in the community. That's a value. Awesome. We can look forward to someone who's going to always do hospital visitation. You know what I'm saying? So we've done another document that just says, let's get it all out on the table. And then we give you these quadrants where you say, hey, either they're coming toward us, we're coming toward them. Or we're coming toward them, they're running from us. They're running toward us, we're running from them. Or, you know, those kind of things. And we're basically saying, you got to be assessing and constantly reassessing who should be on the launch team. One last comment, and then, Ben, I think we got to wrap this thing up. But here's my last comment, is that there's a difference. The reason we try to stay away from the word core group, because core group sounds like I'm in the fraternity till Jesus comes, right? I'm in the core. What you want at the beginning of any project, you want to give away jobs, not give away roles. So rather than say, you're the director of children's ministry, say, hey, could you run the children's ministry for X amount of time? Okay. And, I mean, that's just some stuff I'm belching out at you right now. So the same thing is, be careful about, I mean, who's ever the church planter, they need to be discerning who's on their launch team, not anybody else. Okay, we're going to move on and just give you our contact stuff at the end here because we're hitting our time. That's the book. You can find it somewhere online somewhere, but it's a good book.
What's your email address?
Tom. In fact, I'm going to pull this up. Tom.Nebel, N-E-B-E-L at giantworldwide.com, and Tom P. Nebel. Yeah, so we've got our...
Otherwise, I gave you that m.-moves website. That's got the values assessment on it. You can steal it there, like Tom said, and help yourself and use the tools. Otherwise, contact us. Let us know how we can serve you.
Yeah, we'll send you any of this. Okay, gang, we're going to lean into the Lord right now, okay? God, I pray this stuff goes well, and we pray against the work of the evil one that just wants to take the joy and kill, steal, and destroy. God, for your kingdom, for the sake of the lost, and for our joy, we pray that these dreams that are resident in this room will flourish and go beyond their imaginations. Help us to be good stewards. In Jesus' name, amen.